Good morning, everyone. 8:06 on your Tuesday morning. It's September 14th. I am Sean Higgins, sitting in for Leslie Thatcher this morning. I'm looking at 45 degrees here in Park City at the moment, 46 down in Heber, but on the line with a full forecast at the ABC Forecast Center down in Salt Lake City, we have meteorologist Thomas Gaboy. Good morning, Thomas, and it looks like it's going to be quite a nice week here in Utah. What are you seeing?
Yeah, good morning, Sean. It is going to be beautiful weather as we go throughout the rest of this week. So we're starting off on the cool side this morning. So definitely maybe a sweater as you're heading out the door. But this afternoon, we're looking at temperatures in the middle 70s in Park City with an abundance of sunshine. There might be a little thin layer of smoke out there, but it's not going to be anything like we've seen over recent weeks where it just doesn't look all that pleasant outside. We get mostly sunny skies, maybe a little bit of smoke, but nothing that's too bad. Then into tonight, it's a mostly clear sky with temperatures dropping into the upper 40s, into the lower 50s. So it's going to be another chilly night. And what we find today is more or less going to be on repeat over the next couple of days. I think we'll be a little bit warmer for Wednesday and Thursday with a daytime high tomorrow at 77 degrees and on Thursday with a high of 76, while overnight lows will meet more so in the lower 50s. So cool nights and very comfortable afternoons. Then as we go throughout your Thursday into your Friday, it's just more of the same. Overnight lows, lower 50s, daytime highs, middle 70s, during the days. We'll be looking at mostly sunny skies, maybe a few clouds in there, maybe a little bit of smoke as well. But again, nothing that's going to be too significant out there. But what we're watching now at this point is a pattern change does look like it's going to be on the way as we turn the page into the early stages of next week. So a system coming in from the Pacific Northwest is going to help knock down the temperatures a little bit. So by the time we get into your Sunday, the daytime high might only be in the upper 60s. Still looking at a mostly sunny sky. Then from Sunday night into Monday, we could introduce a small shower chance. But at that point, the temperature will really start to cool off, and we could be talking about real fall-like temperatures with Sunday night dropping into the middle 40s. Then on Monday, again, a small chance of showers, but we'll still get that mostly sunny skies. Daytime highs will be in the lower 60s. So with the leaves beginning to change, it'll definitely kind of feel the part as we turn the page into next week.
Thomas, thank you for that, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.
Sounds good. Looking forward to it.
Well, in a yearly tradition that falls somewhere between a bike race, fundraiser, and a party, the 2021 Tour de Suds had a strong showing on Sunday. KPCW's Ben Lassiter has more.
As usual, all 400 spots in the Tour de Suds filled up for Sunday's race. Bikers in costume charged through 7 miles of trails, gaining 2,700 feet of elevation along the way. After the climb, riders celebrated with suds, aka beer. For some, it was a race, while for others, it was a party on bikes. Mountain Trails Foundation Executive Director Laura Smith, an organizer of Tour de Suds, says it was all of the above and a great day overall.
It was amazing. The smoke cleared, the weather cooperated, the roster filled up. We had a full race and then some. It couldn't have been a better turnout. I mean, the community loves this race. It's more like a party on bikes than it is a race. Really, it's just about getting the community together and celebrating, you know, our legacy of great mountain biking.
Smith didn't have information about money raised yet, but says the foundation usually just aims to break even. She says her organization was more focused on hosting a fun event for the community. In women's race results, Addison Lundberg and Elle Deshane won the teenager categories, Sophia Hamilton won the 20 to 29 category, Amanda Felder won among 30 to 39-year-olds, and Megan Sheridan won among 40 to 49-year-olds with the fastest overall time of 54 minutes and 55 seconds. Roxanne Tolley won the 50s category, Leslie Riddle the 60s, and Nancy Fichter was the sole racer in the 70-plus category. Among men's winners, Bean Altshuler was the fastest of the 9-and-unders, Sam Kirshner and Maddox Leonard won the 10 through 20 categories, Fletcher Taylor won the 20s age group, Barrett Brandon edged out DJ Harper in the 30s, and Jason Hendrickson won the 40s with the fastest overall time of a second under 49 minutes. Andy Bierman led the 50s category. Gail Shaw won a close race in the 60s over Charles Brisby and Greg Bromka, and Chris McMaster was the winner of the 70s and over. Some riders were toting children. Bradley Kaysen was the fastest man to do so, and to lead the women's category, Bonnie Kaysen was only 2 seconds slower. Ben Lassiter, KPCW News.
Well, members of the Snyderville Planning Commission, along with county staff, are working to revise their code on landscaping and change how we use and manage water. But Development Director Pat Putt says the county isn't coming to rip out your existing lawn. Rick Bruff has more.
During his recent visit with KPCW, Putt said that Snyderville commissioners had a good discussion in August about the code governing landscaping and riparian features. He said they intend to have another work session in late September.
What we're trying to achieve through this is a code that's more predictable, easier to use, creates an expectation up front for both property owners, our landscape designers, our landscaping firms. And the idea is to the best that we can as a community, be more efficient on how we water.
Putt said their existing code is pretty vigorous in governing landscapes for commercial areas or multifamily projects, but has been silent on single-family housing. One resource he's looking at, he said, is Utah State University, which has recommended a drought-tolerant plant list specifically for Summit County.
You know, is it going to ultimately require, you know, people to remove all their existing turf and look like something that, you know, out of, you know, the Maricopa County, Phoenix area? We don't believe so.
Putt said there are several neighborhoods that have shown a way forward for low water use landscaping. One of those is Promontory.
Promontory, through their HOA and their design guidelines, have developed what I think is a very viable low water use landscaping irrigation plan that they use inside sort of their public rights of way and their public facilities. It's a combination of both drip low water use irrigation systems and an idealized kind of plant list. There's a lot of native grasses and plants that thrive under a low water use environment that are actually quite colorful, and those colors change throughout the seasons. And
Putt said the county will need to call on water providers, HOAs, and residents to be responsible stewards.
And the idea is to set some expectation now, and as we move forward, incentivize people to make the existing changes in their existing yards, but for new construction, start from day one. So we think we can get there.
County Development Director Pat Putt for KPCW. I'm Rick Bruff.
Well, Summit County is mulling over a potential $50 million general obligation bond for open space in the county. Joining me now is Wendy Fisher from Utah Open Lands and Cheryl Fox from the Summit Land Conservancy to talk about what the bond is and what it could mean for open space in Summit County. Wendy, good morning, and Cheryl, good morning as well.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. Glad we have one in studio, one on the line right now, so we got to do that little dance right now. So, Wendy, let's start with you. This $50 million is a maximum level, so there's no guarantee that it will be a full $50 million, correct?
Yeah. What we understand is that the council was looking at up to $50 million, but they haven't made that ultimate decision. I think many people are familiar with the various different open space bonds that have passed. And out in the Snyderville Basin, the greatest bond was $25 million. Of course, there was the Treasure Hill Armstrongs and Ranch Pastures open space bond that was here in the city for $48 million. So I think they were looking at a number of things, one of those being the rising price of real estate in the county.
Mm-hmm. And Cheryl, how long has this particular bond been in the works, and how long have you been involved in this process?
Well, we learned in late August that the county council was seriously considering putting a bond on the ballot for this coming November. But there have been talks for a number of years about finding a better way to save farms and ranches in eastern Summit County. And it's coming a little bit fast at us right now. But on the other hand, I think the council has felt like the time is right. Interest rates are low. And if we are going to save some of the beautiful spaces that remain, we kind of need to get out in front of it.
And same story for you as well, Wendy? Same timeline, roughly?
Yeah, I think that what we've seen from Utah Open Lands perspective, we've been protecting open space in Summit County for 31 years now. And I remember back in the day when there were no open space bonds. And so you were completely reliant upon the tax deductions that come from conservation easements. And then as open space bonds started to be a thing, both in Summit County and elsewhere in the in Utah. What we found was that the tax incentives and then even private contributions can help leverage those bond dollars. And so on many of these open space bonds, we've been able to leverage it even 3-to-1 in some instances by utilizing these other ways to raise money to preserve these open spaces. But I think the key that we've seen is that without an open space bond, it's really hard. It's hard to get state funds, it's hard to get federal funds. And so I think the talks that have happened over several years, if we want to have meaningful open space preservation, especially in the rest of Summit County outside of the Snyderville Basin and Park City, it's really going to take the possibility of general obligation bond, because that is the only way that they can do that in the rest of the county.
Mm-hmm. And I understand that a GO bond, this general obligation bond, can only be done on a general election ballot, so that's why it's specifically for this November. Past open space bonds, how have they been approached? Has it been a general obligation bond, or has it been something different?
Well, in the state of Utah, there are the only ways you can really do a bond is if you have a resort designation, if you're a county of a certain class, or if you have a special service district. So in the past, that's kind of been what has happened for open space bonds, and that's why we've seen them in the special service district of the Snyderville Basin Special Recreation District. That's why we've been able to see them, obviously, in Park City. So yes, the general obligation bond is the only way that we can do it for a countywide bond. So this would be actually the very first open space bond for the entire county.
And I also understand this would also be the first time that there's ever requested an open space tax increase from residents outside of the Snyderville Basin. How has the buy-in been from the east side of the county, and how are they receiving it so far? Either one of you can take that. I'm not sure who is better equipped for that.
Well, I think that, Sean, this is Cheryl from the Summit Land Conservancy. I think there's that is a really valid question, and it'll be really interesting to see how people in, countywide feel about this. But in talking to members of the Eastern Summit County Agricultural Preservation Committee, which has been a committee that's been in place for about 20 years, and it is tasked with using funds that are provided for agricultural preservation through sales of lots in the Promontory development. That was actually set up by the Promontory developers. That fund is diminishing, and it's almost gone. And so there's been a lot of concern from people who've been working for farm and ranch land protection in Eastern Summit County for a number of years about how are we going to go forward and continue to be able to save the farms and ranches along the Weber River, save some of the big agricultural heritage ranches up in the mountains surrounding the valleys of Summit County. And so I think a lot of people have told me anyway that, you know, it could be time. It could actually be time, because if we don't get a bond like this passed, there's really very few resources for the longtime landowning families to be able to save their heritage.
And Cheryl, if you could talk a little bit more about what this money will actually go towards. Saving open space, obviously, will this go towards trails at all, other recreational uses, trailheads, parking lots, restrooms, things like that?
It's my understanding that this bond has some flexibility in what it can actually be used for. So it could support some open space services, if you will. So I think there's been some interest in, for example, some support for wildlife corridors and fencing and things like that. It could be used to purchase conservation easements to help save farms and ranches. It could also be used to purchase land that might be needed for a park or something along those lines. The county council has not designated any one particular project at this point. You know, the last two bonds that we passed in Park City, one was for, as Wendy said, the Treasure Hill Armstrong Snow Ranch Pastures projects, and the one before that was to preserve Bonanza Flat. And so for those two bonds, we did have a project already in mind. In this situation, we don't, but I think it would be important to remember that until those last two bonds, the bonds that had been passed in Park City and the Snyderville Basin, we never knew exactly what we were going to be able to save. What we did know was if we didn't have money in the bank, in essence, we would not be able to save anything.
Mm-hmm. Wendy, if you could kind of talk a little bit about, has there been pushback that you've heard from around the county, and are there concerns, and what are those concerns that have been voiced about this GO bond?
I haven't really heard pushback so much as I think that there are a number of questions that we've received from various different folks. The bottom line is everybody gets this is about quality of life. And if we don't preserve these open spaces, we can't have trails. If we don't preserve these open spaces, we lose the critical habitat for wildlife. If we don't preserve these open spaces, we also are in danger of hurting our water quality in our watershed. Everybody gets that. We're a sophisticated county. We understand what we like. I think what I've heard in terms of pushback is, you know, are all of these lands going to be permanently protected under conservation easements? Obviously, as a land trust, having done this for 31 years and having seen the other side where lands that were supposed to be protected haven't been protected, I think that, yes, they should have a conservation easement on it. But that's something that I think the community can let the council know. I think the other thing that's come up is really, what is that right number? And what are we going to be able to preserve with that amount of money? And it's a tough question because, again, with the real estate values that are there, that becomes a really tough thing to understand is how much money do we need to leverage the real protection that needs to happen in the county? I know that I've seen a number of landowners who desperately want to preserve this land as a legacy for the community to pass it on to the next generation, and because they understand what it means to the overall quality of life that we have here in Summit County. But they can't, because they can't just afford to take the inheritance that they would pass on to the next generation and forego all of that. They're still willing to make contributions. And being able to have some money that is available for us to go ahead and leverage that and work with these landowners would be phenomenal. So I think that that's what we're seeing is, what is the impact that this can have? How is it going to be, you know, managed as we go forward? And really, are we going to be able to get some of those quality landscapes? And we think that's why it's really important to make sure that there's public input, to let the county know what's important to people. What do they want to see? What are some of the advice about what that number should be?
Mm-hmm. And Cheryl, if you could talk really brief or quickly, not as, take as long as you want, actually, if there are specific properties that are being targeted right now for preservation, or is this kind of just a preemptive measure that in case something comes on the market that would be ripe for the picking, so to speak, preserved property?
Well, I can say that there is a property that the Summit Land Conservancy is working on right now with the landowners, and if this bond does not pass, I don't think we'll be able to save it. But we are early in the talks with this project and are not comfortable at this point going public on that. But I do want to say, back to what Wendy was talking about in terms of the Summit Land Conservancy's quality of life and your earlier question, I have heard people concerned because, as you know, there is another bond on the ballot for people who live in the Park City School District. So there will be two bonds on the ballots for people on the west side of Summit County. And I think going back to what Wendy was saying about quality of life and how really important it is that we step up and recognize that, you know, the open spaces that we have right now in the Park City area were not protected by accident, and they were not protected for free. They were protected because our community said, wow, you know, we really need to step in and be proactive and pass some open space bonds so that we can protect this land. At the same time, the quality of our schools is also important to our future and our legacy, clearly. And so I think it's really important that people take a minute to think about, you know, what is it that really does make our community so unique and important, and I hope people will consider supporting both of these measures on the ballot.
So I want to talk a little bit about some of the numbers. We heard the county's chief financial officer, Matt Levitt, said this will be probably be about a 20-year bond, and said that for the average primary residence with a market value of about just under $700,000, I imagine that's a little skewed when you consider the greater Park City area and the average price of a single-family home here. An owner would pay about $45 to $50 for the first year, and said costs could decrease if property values increase. Wendy, how does that work?
Well, I think there are a couple of things that probably are being factored into that, and math may not be my strong suit, so you'll have to bear with me. But what we've seen in the past is really what happens with these bonds is it really depends on what is the interest rate that they get. We're fortunate here in Summit County to have a very high bond rating. The thing that they look at is you have a AA, AAA bond rating. Those bond ratings, then you have competition in the market for people to bid on those bonds. All of those things are great things when it comes down to what is the individual homeowner going to have to pay for the bond. So I think that's why there's probably a little bit of squishiness in terms of what we know people are going to pay for the average home. And as you say, you know, that may be skewed a little bit. So all of those things come into play. And of course, if you're listening to the news even just this morning, right, there's always that talk about whether or not the feds are going to raise interest rates, and that will affect the bond rating, and that will affect ultimately the cost. But that was also, I believe, probably one of the factors in terms of determining whether or not it was the right time to put some of these different bonds on the ballot, because the interest rates right now are fairly favorable for something like this.
Mm-hmm. We mentioned public input being a really important part of this process. Cheryl, I see a couple of dates on the calendar. What is next? How can people get involved in this process?
That's right. So on September 22nd, the County Council will be taking public input on this bond proposal. September 22nd is at the Ledges Event Center in Colville. And then on September 29th, the following week, they'll be taking public input at the Sheldon Richens Building. People can also email the County Council, and those email addresses are easily found on the Summit County's website.
Wendy, anything else you want to add before we wrap it up?
I think that one of the things that is important is to understand that as we grow as a community, there are these values and these resources that are really precious, and those are open lands and certainly our education as well. And so sometimes it does come down to not a question of either or, but maybe both. And it's a tough decision. We think that one of the critical things is for people to go to the County Council and talk about what they anticipate, what they expect the county to do with respect to acquiring these open spaces, what is that right number, and how to permanently protect them. Because I can tell you, as Cheryl said, without these funds, there's a lot of properties that we want to save that we know just won't happen.
Cheryl, anything else from you?
I just want to second what Wendy said. It's a time to kind of gather together as a community around some of the values that we think are truly important. And I hope that people will ask the questions that they need to ask. They can also reach out to us at the Summit Land Conservancy at wesaveland.org, and I'm sure Wendy would field questions as well. And, you know, so that people feel comfortable when it's time to go to the ballot.
All right. Well, that's Wendy Fisher from Utah Open Lands and Cheryl Fox from the Summit Land Conservancy. Summit County is considering a up to $50 million general obligation bond for open space in the county to be on the ballot this November. Important dates coming up: September 22nd, a public hearing and meeting regarding the bond held at the Ledges. And on September 29th, a second meeting held at the Richens Building during council. Wendy and Cheryl, thank you both so much for joining us this morning, and we'll talk to you both soon.
Thank you.
Well, leaves aren't the only things that change color in the fall. Kokanee salmon are famous for their bright red colors during their spawning season, too. And as it turns out, people can go and view the spawning fish this fall at several local reservoirs. Channing Howard is the event development and coordination specialist for the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources and joins me right now to talk all about it and some other wildlife events happening throughout the state. Good morning, Channing, and thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for having me.
So what is so special about kokanee salmon? They turn red, they get humpbacks, hooked jaws, elongated teeth, but what else is unique about these fish?
Kokanee salmon are pretty special here in Utah. They're the only landlocked salmon species here. So basically they are, they're like a species of salmon you might think of in the Pacific Northwest that spends most of its life in the Pacific Ocean and then comes up the rivers to spawn. However, it's completely landlocked, so it is in fresh water its entire life cycle.
And
here in Utah.
Go ahead, sorry.
Oh, yeah, and here in Utah, we've got quite a few places around the state where these fish live year-round, and it's spawning season right now, so they are changing colors, like you mentioned, and the hook jaws and everything.
And so these fish are not native to Utah, then?
I can't speak to that specifically, but kokanee are very familiar to a lot of folks that live here in Utah. They've been around here in the state for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually have an egg-taking facilities where we actually help the species survive by taking the eggs and spawning them and releasing the fry back into certain bodies of water.
And do kokanee die after they spawn like some other species of salmon?
They do. So that's the end of their life cycle. So kokanee spawn anywhere from about two to 6 years of age, give or take. And once they turn bright red, they get their hooked jaw, the hump backs, they swim up the river to go spawn, and that completes their life cycle after they lay their eggs, deposit sperm, and then they're done. They have completed their entire life cycle.
So where can we actually see these fish? I was looking at the list of places, quite a few here in the Wasatch Back, Strawberry Reservoir, Jordanelle, Provo River, Smith and Morehouse, State Line. If we had to pick one of those places, what would be your best place to see the kokanee this fall?
This year, I would highly recommend checking out Strawberry Reservoir. In fact, the Division of Wildlife is hosting a kokanee salmon viewing day this Saturday from 9 to 3. We're hosting at the Forest Service Visitor Center right there off of Highway 40, right at the beginning of Strawberry Reservoir. Folks can come there. They can see salmon spawning up Strawberry River. There's also, that's where the egg-taking facility is, so if you want to walk around the boardwalk and see the fish in there. They're very easily visible from that area. And then at this event, we will actually have some of our outreach staff and our biologists there to answer questions about the fish, about the area, and help you understand a little bit more about the kokanee's life cycle here in Utah.
And will you need to register beforehand for this event? Does it cost anything to participate?
Yeah, no, this event is absolutely free, but we do ask participants to register ahead of time so we get an idea of how many people to expect. You can find all of our events on the division's website, wildlife.utah.gov. And for this event, you can sign up through our Eventbrite registration.
And if people unfortunately miss this event this weekend at the Strawberry Reservoir, are there going to be other formal spawning events that the DWR puts on?
This will be our only formal event this year, but there's lots of places where you can see the fish spawning in different areas throughout the fall. And the Strawberry Reservoir is one place you can come back to with or without this event to view the fish in the river. We do want to remind everybody to make sure you leave the salmon alone as they're swimming up the stream. Don't let your dog bother them. Just watch them. Some other great areas that are known for good kokanee salmon are Jordanelle River Reservoir and Provo River. If you're in the Summit County area, those are some great areas. If you're up in the northern part of the state, Causey Reservoir and Porcupine, Smith and Morehouse, and State Line Reservoir are also some areas to see them. And then down in the southeastern part of the state, we have Electric Lake and Fish Lake. Each area might have slightly different times for spawning, so keep your eyes peeled if you go visit sometime in the next month.
And if we do show up to one of these reservoirs, because kind of on our own trying to find some fish, where should we be looking?
Should be looking in the rivers that flow in and out of the lakes. In the Jordanelle Reservoir, they're going to spawn up the Provo River. So you're going to want to go to the Provo River Inlet and take a peek there and see if you can see any of the red fish in the stream.
And is there anything fishermen in particular need to know during spawning season? Are there restrictions on these fish at certain times of year?
Yes, absolutely. So from September 10th to November 30th, this is their approximate spawning season throughout the state. We ask that fishermen do not keep any kokanee salmon that are caught. So if you do catch one of the big redfish, be careful with it. Follow all the safe fish handling guidelines. If you want to, take a quick picture and put it back in the water and release it safely so it can finish its spawning cycle.
And I understand Strawberry Reservoir, in particular, is also well known for the cutthroat trout population. That's another protected fish in Utah. Is that around the same time they spawn, or is that in the springtime?
I'm not a fisheries biologist, so I would have to refer you to our fisheries biologist to get the details on our cutthroat trout in the Strawberry Reservoir. It'd be a good opportunity to ask questions of our staff at the event this weekend.
Sounds great. So I understand there are some other wildlife events happening throughout the state right now, a building exhibit at the state fair. Anything else we should have our eye on if we're looking to learn about some Utah wildlife?
Yeah, the state fair is actually a great opportunity to come learn a little bit more about our migration, wildlife migration initiative. So that was started in 2017, and we wanted to know more about the movements of a lot of our animals across the state. And one of the biggest goals for this program is to identify areas where animals migrate through certain spots where they might be hindered by a barrier, whether that's a road or a fish that may not be able to finish its spawning upstream. And we are highlighting at the fair all of the technology that we use to help us understand these movements. So we've got wildlife collars for our deer, elk, moose. We're also highlighting all the different tags that we use on our fish, such as pit tags or a Foy tag, to help us monitor our fish populations and identify their migration routes. So I highly recommend coming to the state fair. We also have a live desert tortoise and boreal toads, both native species to Utah, that require a lot of effort to help keep those animals from being on the endangered species list.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you real quick, temperatures are dropping. It is middle of hunting season right now. Lots of people are going to be out enjoying Utah's public lands. For the general public, what are some general tips to stay as safe as possible if they are out in the wilderness at the same time as some of these big hunts in Utah are happening?
Yeah, so one of the biggest pieces of advice, if you're in an area where you think there's going to be a lot of hunting, you can always wear a big spot of hunter orange. That helps other hunters that are out there identify you as a person. During our rifle hunts, we do require people to wear, our hunters to wear orange. So you might see people wearing orange while you're out in the field. It's also advisable you can put some orange on your dog if you're concerned about being in an area where there's hunters and having your dog running around. But just keep your eyes open, and there's enough land out there for everybody to share during the hunting season.
There sure is. Anything else for us, Channing, before we let you go?
We've got one more event coming up for youth. It's called the Youth Waterfowl Hunting Seminar, and it's Friday, September 17th. At the Lee K Public Shooting Range. We have a couple spots left for this free event. For any youth that are interested in learning about hunting waterfowl, the youth waterfowl season starts about mid-September to the beginning of October, depending on what area you're hunting. But it's the youth waterfowl season opens up before the general season. So it gives youth an opportunity to hunt outside of the general population. So it's a good opportunity for youth that are interested in getting into waterfowl.
And Lee K is the shooting range in Salt Lake, right? West Valley?
Salt Lake City.
Yeah.
Yes.
Gotcha. Well, Channing, thank you so much for your time. Really interesting to learn about the kokanee and everything else going on with the Utah DWR. Once again, kokanee salmon are spawning this fall several areas around the Wasatch Back. Strawberry Reservoir is a highlight, Jordanelle and Provo River. Smith and Morehouse Reservoir, State Line Reservoir here in Summit County and Wasatch County. Please register for this weekend's event at Strawberry Reservoir beforehand. And what was the website to go register for that one more time, Channing?
You can go to wildlife.utah.gov and find our events page there.
Wonderful. Channing Howard, she's the Event Development and Coordination Specialist for the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. Channing, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the Jan's Winter Welcome will hold its annual fundraiser to support youth winter sports in Park City next month. The Youth Sports Alliance says while the virtual fundraiser was successful last year, organizers hope to hold this year's event in person. KPCW's Ben Lassiter has more on that.
The Jan's Winter Welcome fundraises for more than 2,800 kids every year. It's happening this year on Tuesday, October 26th. The kids are participants in competitive sports and after-school programs through the Youth Sports Alliance, such as Get Out and Play and Activate. As of now, the plan is to gather as many as 400 members of the community and from across the country at the Stein Erickson Lodge, including some who are in the snow sports industry. Youth Sports Alliance Executive Director Emily Fisher says that's the plan under current COVID-19 guidelines, but organizers will change it if necessary.
We've all learned to pivot and figure out how to do things differently, and so we have a plan A, which is running the event as usual, that we hope we'll be able to do, and then we have a plan B and C and D and E, so we'll see how it goes.
A normal year brings in about $400,000, and Fisher says the Alliance was able to meet its target last year despite having to hold the fundraiser virtually. Fundraising comes from ticket sales and silent and live auctions. This year, one lucky ticket holder for an opportunity drawing will get an all-inclusive trip to Santa Barbara Wine Country.
What we do every year is we provide that opportunity drawing item, and then the 7-member clubs and the Youth Sports Alliance sell those tickets, and the ticket sales go back to those clubs at 100%. So if you want to support a specific club, a specific athlete, you can do that online, just ysaparkcity.org. You can find those opportunity drawing tickets.
For a link to the Youth Sports Alliance website, visit kpcw.org. Ben Lassiter, KPCW News.
Well, Wasatch County recorded another COVID-19 death last Friday. The county has now seen 26 deaths from the disease since the start of the pandemic. A man between the ages of 45 and 64 was identified as Wasatch County's 26th COVID-19 fatality on Friday. Vaccination rates in the Wasatch Back are on par with and even outperforming statewide numbers. According to the State Health Department, just over 62% of eligible Utahns over the age of 12 are fully vaccinated. Summit County is at 82%, and Wasatch County Health Department Public Information Officer and Epidemiologist Chris Smoot said Wasatch County is sitting at just over 60%.
If you look at our numbers versus state numbers, we're in the top third, I believe, of the health districts and counties as far as vaccination rates. Still room to grow, but we understand this is a very personal decision, and we want people to make educated decisions regarding their health. We do recommend vaccination, but we understand people should have that chance to consult with their health care provider and make the best choice for them.
Smoot said the lowest vaccination rates in Wasatch County are among children between the ages of 12 and 18, with about 53% having received at least one dose. He added the older the age group, the more people are vaccinated. Currently, health districts in rural and southern Utah have the lowest percentage of vaccinated people in the state. Unvaccinated people can contact a trusted healthcare provider for more information on the vaccine and find a free vaccine location at vaccines.gov. Well, the Christian Center of Park City has a number of things happening this fall. And on the line with me now, we have Executive Director of the Christian Center of Park City, Rob Harder, to talk all about it. Good morning, Rob, and thank you for joining us.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
For sure. So I understand that the Hike for Hunger is actually coming up this Sunday, and it's actually Hunger Action Month. What else can we learn about that?
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. So here's what's interesting. So we're at the St. Regis this year. Typically, people probably know the Hike for Hunger, you know, outside of the COVID year. We've always been at Deer Valley, and we've had a, you know, can have an unlimited amount, in a sense, of people, 700-800 people. St. Regis, though, it limits us to 200 people, which is super exciting. They even have 200, and we've sold out. So our event this Sunday is sold out, which we're super excited about. But as you mentioned, this is also Hunger Action Month. And so we just encourage people, if they didn't get a chance to sign up, or if they were, you know, previous years, you could kind of show up day of. Unfortunately, we can't do that this year. However, you can still support our food pantries and all of our efforts to really address hunger in this community. I've mentioned it before with on Leslie's show. You know, there's more hunger than people realize, and it's right here in Summit County and Wasatch County. And obviously, COVID, we really saw it where, you know, there was a time during COVID we were serving 1,000 people a week. And so, now that was an extreme case, but the reality is just hunger is here, and we try to do everything we can to address that. And then we just not only work regionally, but we've been able to work throughout the state and working with other food pantries as well.
Wow, that's incredible. So Hunger Action Month, is that specifically for the Christian Center, or is that a statewide effort or a national effort as well?
Yeah, great question. That is a national effort. It's really overseen by Feeding America, and that's a great question because Feeding America, again, maybe people know, maybe they don't. Feeding America is kind of like the national food bank organization, if you will, and then they have a network of food banks in every state. So we work with Utah Food Bank here locally, as well as Community Action. They also have a food bank based in Provo. So, but Utah Food Bank is kind of the primary largest food bank in the state, and again, it's connected to Feeding America. They're the ones that kind of launch this Hunger Awareness Month, Hunger Action Month. So the nice thing about that is, yeah, it's a nationwide effort to address these issues of food insecurity and the fact that, again, hunger is often hidden in our country, I believe. And yet there's so much food. There's plenty of food available. It really just getting the food to people and making sure there's access for people to get it.
And if people are interested in donating food to the food bank, what are you looking for? Are you looking for canned food that's shelf stable, or can you donate produce, things that are more perishable?
You know, all the above in a sense. Now, we do typically, if people are going to donate, we've typically asked for non-perishable just because then that way we can, you know, keep it and use it as long as possible. However, like certainly through the summer, now we're, of course, we're the tail end of summer, some people are still having kind of season-ending harvest, and so we love being able to give fresh vegetables, fresh fruit, so we're always open to that. But I'd say, like, it's funny you ask that, because in another month or so is typically our food drive season. So businesses around the state and the city, and then of course National Honor Society at Park City High School has one of the biggest food drives that we do, and they usually start that in November. We typically do shelf stable, as you mentioned, food. Now, having said that, another thing that we ask for all the time, because it's something that our recipients need, even though food pantry is often the primary thing people come for, we also give diapers. We have feminine hygiene products, formula. Those are big needs that are quite expensive, and they can continue to get even more expensive. And so that's a list of items, too, that I would actually encourage people to just do a diaper drive or do a feminine hygiene product drive, because that is something that people ask for, they need it, and it's a huge help in addition to the food. So they can also throw that in if they wanted to donate to the food pantry.
Great to know that we can donate more than just food. So
yeah.
Talking a little bit more about the Hike for Hunger, where is this hike and how long is it going to be?
Yeah, so it's at St. Regis, and it's this Sunday. So it starts at 2 o'clock. And so we want to make it really a hunger awareness event. It's mostly for a fun gathering, you know, for the community to come out. It looks like the weather's going to be perfect. So basically what you do is you start at St. Regis, and there's three different trails from there. There's the kind of a hard, medium, and easy trail. And then we'll come back, and there's food and drinks, and there'll be face painting and a bunch of activities there on the plaza. They call it the Grand Mesa Plaza there at the St. Regis. So just kind of fun way to for the community again to come together, learn about a good cause, enjoy the beautiful outdoors that we get to enjoy here in Deer Valley and in Park City. So that is this Sunday. And again, unfortunately, it's sold out, but make sure you know next year our hope is we'll get a little bit bigger venue so we can have more people, because we typically do have more like 600 to 700 people at the Hike for Hunger, and we're hoping to expand it again back to its normal size next year.
Sounds great. So I want to talk a little bit about the rent assistance that the Christian Center is providing. I understand you're still providing it, but the requests are decreasing. Can we talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked about that. Yeah, so since COVID started, we've given out about $1.6 million worth in rent assistance, and that's just to show you the need and how massive it's been, and also to show how incredible the support from the community has been to be able to have that much money to then disperse out to residents that really were struggling with staying in their home or staying in their apartment. So, but you're right. Ironically, about 2 months ago, we actually saw an uptick right before the eviction moratorium, you know, kind of got lifted. We actually started seeing some evictions being issued, and then more than just evictions, what we were seeing were landlords were often raising their apartment rates at a really, really high percentage, where the, you know, they had locked in at a certain rate, and then all of a sudden now the rent rate went up by 25-30% or higher, and they couldn't afford it. So we were trying to fill that gap to keep them in there, and, or help them find another more affordable unit to stay in, and but it's so difficult. Affordable housing is so challenging around here. So that was difficult, I'd say, the last 2 months. Now, you're right, though. Just recently, we had seen a little bit of a dip now. There has not been any evictions, actually, this week yet that we've gotten notice of. That's the first in, I think, since COVID, honestly. So that's a good sign, I think. We hope that, you know, people are not getting evicted and somehow we're not hearing about it. But please, so if you are listening and you get an eviction notice and you need some help, please contact us, because that is something we do want to help with. We also work closely with Mountain Mediation, which I know you've had on your show. And we work together with them, and they're able to provide resources as well to figure out, you know, how you can navigate through this challenge. But we're hoping that with all the, you know, massive response over the last year and a half, that people are kind of caught up now with the rent. And obviously there's jobs out there. There's a lot of jobs available. There's a lot of open positions around. So I think people are able to find work now. So I think we're hoping, cross your fingers, that this will get out of this really serious moment where people are just not sure if they could stay in their place.
We all hope that, I think. If someone is curious about looking into this rental assistance, how is the money decided, and what is an average payment that the Christian Center can deal out every month?
Oh, great question. So it all depends really on several factors. Number one, just, you know, the emergency. So if it's an eviction notice, they typically have 2, maybe 3 days at most, then we respond right away. And we the nice thing is we're nimble enough. We can respond and get them a check typically within 24 hours. And then we check, you know, number one, we kind of look through a list of things. Not only do we want to help with rent, we want to help, have you been to our food pantry? We want to make sure we provide food for them. Do they need clothes? Do they need furniture? Because we have these thrift stores that have wonderful things like that. So we try to go through a whole list of things, so we're not just helping with one need. We try to address holistically all their various needs. Oftentimes, there's also mental health needs that pop up because of the stress and the anxiety and things that are going on. So we're able to provide counseling, too, depending on what the situation is. And then back to the financial piece, we've had a wide range. Like, I'd say that most of the people that have come through have gotten up to $3,000. Now, not maybe all at once. It depends on the need. But the average rent around here now keeps going up. But it was, last I heard, was just under $1,300 is the average rent. And that's for low-income families. So that's the average of what we'd see in terms of they need a full month's worth, that's what they need. And so they are able to, you know, we've been able to help people month after month. But typically right around 3,000 is what we've been giving to families. And then if there's an extenuating need, sometimes we have people that come, not only do they need rent assistance, but they have a medical emergency and they can't afford it. And so depending on the situation, again, and other resources out there, we try to meet that need as much as we can. And then if we can't, save it to $5,000 bill or higher, we try to link up with other organizations. We work really closely with the Jewish Family Services, JFS, plus People's Health Clinic and other nonprofits, even in the Valley. So we try to rally around these other resources to help these families when they have more than just the rent need. So that's typically how we do it. Seriously, if people are listening and they are needing that, happy to talk to them and figure out what their needs are and what we can do.
And speaking of that, what is the best way to contact the Christian Center? Is it by phone, through email, or is there a web portal people can go through?
All the above, yes. I'd say the easiest is go to our website. Yeah, that way you can actually sign up. There's an application online. We found that to be super easy. It just makes the process really efficient. So go online to ccofpc.org and to our basic needs assistance page. And there's actually an application right there. Now, they can always call too. They can stop by. They can email us. You just do admin@ccofpc.org, and one of our team members will be able to get in touch really soon.
All right. And I understand there are some other volunteer opportunities for people in the community coming up. What else can you tell us about those?
Yeah, we love our volunteers, first of all, and we have some great volunteers. And as we continue to grow, we always need more volunteers. So, yeah, I thought I'd just give a shout-out to the various needs and opportunities, really, that are here. And we have everything from if you want to come once a week, work at our food pantry. There's always a need in our food pantry. We have needs for food pickups, to sorting through food, helping with food drives, putting together snacks and backpacks, a whole variety of things. And both in our Heber campus and on our Park City campus. So depending on where your listeners are listening from, we're open to getting volunteers at both campuses. And then the other things are coming up, just to kind of put plant a seed in people's minds. Operation Hope will be coming up, of course, in Christmas time. We always need lots of volunteers and toys. But before that is our big coat drive. We do that. What we learned, actually, we always had coats available at Operation Hope, but we wouldn't do our Operation Hope till in December, right around Christmas time. Well, we understood that a lot of kids, of course, were sitting at bus stops waiting for their bus, and it's freezing cold. The temperature drops, as everyone knows, in the mountain town, you know, right around mid-October to late October. And so we decided to bump up our registration for Operation Hope and combine that with a coat drive. So we've got a coat drive coming up mid-October. So if you have coats you'd like to be a part of, you know, donating the coats or be a part of that program, helping to sign people up for Operation Hope and then help hand out coats, that will be a wonderful thing too. And you can go to our website for that as well. Just go to our ccfpc.org again and look for the volunteer page, or you could reach out to us and just email jessica@ccfpc.org. Jess is our volunteer manager and would love to talk to you and see what availability you would have.
Lots of things going on. Sounds like you'll be pretty busy over the next few months, Rob. Anything else for us before we let you go this morning?
No, thanks for all those good questions. And yeah, I think just to always mention this, the mental health counseling center that we have just continues to grow. We've seen an almost 40% increase just this year, and it was even higher last year because of COVID. But I just want to make sure people are aware that there are so many resources that we have there too, from child therapy to anyone dealing with depression, anxiety, you know, whatever things you may be facing. If you have medication you need managed, we have an APRN that can do medication management. We have health coaches. So we've got just a lot of variety of resources with our counseling and mental health center. Just want to make sure that's available, because we've certainly seen a huge uptick across our country, but certainly right here in Park City and Summit County for mental health. And just want to make sure people know that that is available.
All right, Rob, thank you so much for your time this morning. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks so much for having me.
That is Rob Harder, Executive Director of the Christian Center of Park City.